I'm very glad to introduce Glenn Schneider.
It's a real pleasure to be here this morning, and I'd really like to echo my thanks to Pat and Joanne as well for putting this conference together. It's a first opportunity for me to meet many of you who I've corresponded with over the years through the mailing list, and I wish Michael the best luck picking it up and running that gauntlet now. As Jay said, it really was my pleasure to observe my 25th total solar eclipse from over the Antarctic. And we heard a wonderful talk yesterday from the icebreaker and then the experience that was seen there. But a number of us were really concerned about what the weather might do on the Antarctic coast. So we did plan a flight. Actually, we planned two flights. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that today, more from the perspective of the logistics and planning of that flight than we actually saw in the photographic program we carried out. So I am wearing my eclipse hat, but in order to enable this, I had to become an employee of Qantas Airlines, so I'm going to change hats for the duration of the talk. And I actually maintain a position as the head of the Office of Science and Mission Planning, for which I got paid $1 to make it legal. We'll proceed from that. Whoops. There's a number of ways to describe this eclipse. Of course, it's all known to us as the Antarctic eclipse. It touched down near Heard Island, near the Julian Archipelago, and we saw photographs of that yesterday. The total duration of the track of totality across the Earth was only some 52 minutes. The length of that track was stretched over some 5,000 kilometers. The actual width of the shadow conic, not projected on the Earth, but the conic itself, varied between about 28 and 89 kilometers, and it was in that we were targeting to hit it as a three-dimensional moving target. Of course, it was visible only from the Antarctic, and that's usually how I describe it to people. Nowhere but Antarctica could you see this eclipse, and that's what made it a bit of a logistical challenge. So, was it really accessible? This is the first question that we started asking about 4 years before the event. In 1983, 4, and 5, I actually worked at the South Pole when I was a graduate student and spent some time preparing with the National Science Foundation people trying to find a way to observe the 1985 eclipse from the Antarctic, which we found was just a logistical impossibility in that time of year. It was a little bit earlier than this one, and we couldn't find a way to get there. Well, I flew the eclipse flag anyway from the South Pole, promising we'd return to the Antarctic at some time and do that. So things changed a bit, and thanks to Qantas Airlines, who had been doing tourist overflights since 1990 to the Antarctic, we found a venue that we could actually take advantage of. So there's a commercial company out of Melbourne called Croydon Travel. These are the two principals. This is Phil Asker and Gail Brown. And a few times a year, they charter an aircraft from Qantas and fly over the Antarctic and do tourist flights. And this enabled a plan, as sort of a cost-sharing plan, to make it possible for eclipse chasers to go over the Antarctic to see the eclipse. Renting a 747 for a group of people, one or two at a window, would be prohibitively expensive. So we ended up doing a joint sightseeing flight for the sightseers and eclipse chasing flight for the eclipse chasers. We had to run that by this gentleman here, who's Captain John Dennis, who is going to be at the conference today. His wife has been taken very seriously ill and wasn't able to come up. So he was going to speak a bit to this, and I apologize that he can't be here, and he apologizes as well. I know he would like to have been. John Dennis is a senior training captain, check captain for Qantas Airlines. He has over 7,000 hours in 747 aircraft. He's done 30 trips over the Antarctic over the last 10 years. Still, when we proposed what we wanted to do in terms of the navigation, this was his original response to us. And he said, well, you better put that in writing, because I'm going to have to fly it all the way up the chain in Qantas. So we did. We wrote a technical report, which I have a copy of, if people would like to see it. It's on my website. And after reading that, this was actually more or less his reaction. He just decided, absolutely, he didn't want to go to Melbourne. He wanted to do this eclipse over the Antarctic. And he didn't quite understand eclipses, but he did become a numberphile after that. What was laid out in that document, and I won't describe how we came to this, but the requirements that we levied at them were a number of simultaneous ones. We needed a maximum position error, plus or minus 1 kilometer, as we were flying in terms of lateral position at mid-eclipse contact 2 and contact 3, and vertical position of plus or minus 100 meters. That's not too difficult in the 747, but we also levied on those a time requirement of plus or minus 6 seconds, and that actually is rather difficult to do in a commercial aircraft with the sort of navigation system that they fly over the Antarctic. We also levied a heavy heading requirement in order to keep the sun sort of straight out the airplane windows, if you will. We didn't want to deviate by more than a degree and a half from the optimal heading, and differentially during the eclipse, not more than half a degree. We also had a feed the flight computer periodically with updates based upon changes in wind on the aircraft, and we didn't want to do that at certain times because we didn't want instantaneous heading changes as people were trying to photograph and observe. So we had a predictive integrator running in order to feed it at the right times in order to do that. We also wanted to get the aircraft absolutely as high as possible to get above as much of the atmosphere as we possibly could. We did get above 4/5 of the atmosphere in order to do that. The duration, of course, was a driver to try to get the maximum duration. And, of course, as you proceed along the path in sort of this two-dimensional diagram, we emphasize that you need to stay near center line because you drop off in duration as you move toward the edge of the conic. And also we wanted to observe very, very near local moon, but we weren't quite at it. We couldn't get that far. But that was subject to a number of constraints. Atmospherics, of course, meteorology. We didn't want to be obscured by clouds, so we did look at a 7-year history made available by Qantas from their Antarctic overflights and also the ground research programs going on in order to understand what the obscuration from high-level clouds would be, as well as wind speeds and vector gradients for the winds, and trying to understand how that affects flight-level turbulence and where we're going to go, which is penetrating to about a latitude of 70 degrees south. And it's probably hard to see in this projection here, but the wind is actually quite benign at high levels. Typically 10 kilometers or so and flowing in a clockwise rotation around the pole. So it's actually a very good place to do an overflight. We were constrained wanting to go high by how much fuel we could take on, but that was counter to how far we wanted to penetrate. So there was a real balance that we were doing here, where we wanted to intercept, how high we could go, where we could get the best weather, and being able to carry enough tourists to make it economically viable for the eclipse chasers. So the various sorts of things that fed into the constraints were not just the normal, we want to see as long an eclipse and get the best weather as we possibly could. We were also concerned about possible takeoff delays or in-flight delays, so the Croydon people programmed all of the sightseeing up front so that if there was anything wrong in terms of the delay, well, the sightseers would just have to take it and we would do the eclipse first and worry about the sightseeing later. Also feeding into what we were doing, of course, is the normal motions of the relative motions of the Sun, Moon, and Earth, the normal sort of ephemeris calculations that you do to figure out where things are. And where we would intercept, the aircraft was moving, actually its speed contributed to our increase in duration of totality, but the shadow was moving 4.5 times faster than the aircraft, simply because of the very near polar geometry of the eclipse. The Earth's rotation doesn't help you very much there. So we gained about a half minute of totality by using an aircraft, but not as much as you normally would. We also fed in pressure and temperature-corrected scale height models for the atmosphere, worrying about refraction. It's not very much, but we wanted to hit this thing rather precisely. And we were feeding in a diagram here from Fred, dynamically recomputing what the moon's profile was as we were flying along the flight in order to get contact times as accurately as we could in positioning the aircraft. The baseline plan is sort of laid out here, but what it really comes down to is we defined a run start position, a run in position, and the center line intercept on the basis of all of that. This is sort of the baseline plan. And what that would do was get us an entry at about 68 degrees south latitude with the sun about 15 degrees up. Mid-eclipse is sort of shown here. The altitude of the sun didn't change very much, and we would break off the run 5 minutes later. Fuel is quite expensive in that sort of an aircraft. And nominally, that gives you a second contact and a third contact time that would have given us, in a no-wind condition, 2 minutes and 34.7 seconds. We actually ended up with about 2 minutes and 31 seconds because we actually did have a bit of a wind. We were fighting a little bit. So this is the track that we actually flew. This shows this overflying journey. We actually didn't quite do that. We cut a little different route from the coast. Ended up 20 minutes ahead of totality, entering onto this track, which we were correcting feeding waypoints along the way if the wind was changing for hitting this intercept at 2244, and that was our time target. So if all else fails, we told John, just follow the arc of the photosphere as it disappeared and just keep it absolutely up and down as much as you possibly could, because where we were flying, this is almost exactly would have gotten us a proper trajectory for a mid-eclipse intercept. So if the aircraft navigation system failed, we did have a flyby by the seat of your pants, which fortunately we didn't have to use. The sun was 15 degrees up above the horizon, 18 degrees up above the astronomical horizon. It was depressed 3.5 degrees from our altitude of 35,000 feet. To put all this together and make it easy to do, a number of years ago I developed a software package called eFlight, which has been updated a number of times, which is an eclipse calculator, but it is specifically designed to really address the problem of putting together this sort of optimization problem for doing an intercept from a moving aircraft. In particular, in the inputs and outputs of the program, they're completely compliant with modern flight management systems. This is the FMS units they use on most commercial aircraft, including the 747. So in terms of the data that gets fed in, it's all in the proper units and so forth, and goes back and forth very easily. The core algorithms I first used in flight in 1986, not in this form, but they were used for planning an overflight over the North Atlantic for this annular total, or today as some people call it, hybrid eclipse. And that all worked very well, so I had confidence in those algorithms. And we did use it in 1992 in a DC-10 flight out over the South Atlantic Ocean. We were quite successful in that intercept. We also used the same program for planning a one-hour totality that we were going to do with an Air France Concorde in 2001 before the fleet became grounded. We never had an opportunity to do that. So there are actually two flights that were planned in this way. One was the Qantas Croydon flight, and the other was I had the pleasure of working with some of the people from Sky and Telescope in defining their flight, and we operated in very different airspace so we wouldn't interfere with each other. In order to define the flight, you're working in kind of a tense environment up in the flight deck. So there's some very simple parameters once it all goes in. You simply put in the time of intercept that you want, if you want to displace yourself relative to the center of the umbra, which we obviously didn't want to do. But you can keep the lights down, that's fine. And various other parameters, windage and so forth, that comes off the FMS is echoed back, and you can check the flight parameters. In terms of tabular form, what's actually used, the information that goes back and forth, co-moving local circumstances are computed. The second and third contact, of course, occur differently than they do on the ground as the aircraft is moving around, and you want to know when that is. The time-correlated information in terms of the aircraft track that you're going to be flying, this is just on 5-second increments right here, but correlated with the position of the umbra, and also showing intercept data in terms of where you need to be in terms of time and relative position. In terms of flying the aircraft, the flight management computer wants to be fed waypoints just like with VPS. They're time correlated in terms of when you need to be where, and it will be rejected if you give it information that it can't actually achieve. And there's sort of a readback countdown to make sure you're on track and have to do corrections if you're not. Fortunately, we were. The screens that are presented back on this laptop sort of look like this, a bit different than the flight management computer, but it makes a nice check, a sanity check, to know that as the shadow is approaching, you can look at the FMS and see its output, which correlates with this, and see what's going on with the shadow. Pre and post totality, the software also helps figure out your intersect track and will compute if you had a proper track to get first and fourth contact, it would do that as well and lay out exactly when that would happen. Because of our sightseeing constraints, reviewing the partial eclipse phases was really purely serendipitous here. So to make sure this all worked, I had a first meeting in December 2003 after coming back from the Australian Outback Eclipse with Captain John Black and his flight crew in Melbourne. And we really worked out in first cut what the interface requirements would be in terms of procedure on the 747 flight deck. And when I was there, I saw this amazing window sitting there and said, I can't just navigate this eclipse, I have to photograph it. You know, the 16 by 26 inch window, good quality optical glass, and I just couldn't let that go. So this was going to be the eclipse I was going to watch, and that's not how it turned out. So there was plenty of space on the floor. The seat's not fully back here. There was a rail system that I thought we might use for attaching some equipment. It looks rather cluttered, but a lot of this can be cleared out in principle. The pilot seat does move quite a bit far forward and give access to floor area and still quite comfortable for flying. So you can do that. What this ended up with was a collaborative program with Jay Pasikoff and others putting four cameras together on a common gyro-stabilized platform that we mounted on the flight deck. I used some commercial gyros, gyros. There's two gyroscopes in each reaction wheels in this package. It's made by a company called Kenyon. It's this particular model, and I highly recommend these if anybody's going shipboard and is thinking about how they may want to stabilize cameras. You need two of these units, so they're orthogonal, and you have three-dimensional control. They work really well. We ended up using four cameras on a common platform, all autonomously controlled by computers, so we didn't have to fiddle with them when they were taking pictures. Two film cameras, one CCD imager, and a video camera that was used for guiding the platform. So there was an SBIG 1600 by 1200 CCD that Jay had gotten on loan from the SBIG people, two film cameras, as I had said, and a video, really a guiding camera, but we used that for assembling images as well. As things were coming together, sort of the prototype platform, you can see how the four cameras mounted. the gyro packages between them to sort of stabilize the platform. And the idea was to make this thing, in some sense, much like a spacecraft. To sort of, it was literally suspended from a bungee cord in order to isolate it so that as the aircraft bumped and moved around it, the platform would remain inertially stable just from the flywheels in the gyros themselves. It was all balanced up so that the platform would point up at an angle of 14.9 degrees and be on the sun, and hopefully just make little adjustments as the platform sort of dithered around, which I'll show you. This is the first integrated sort of system test. I needed two computers. Unfortunately, the CCD driver doesn't work on a Macintosh, my favorite platform, so Jay provided a ThinkPad for that. The rest of the software was driven off the laptop, and this is a first test in my garage before we drove it around in a van to see how stable it would be. But we did need to try it on an aircraft, which we eventually did. In March of 2004, John Dennis brought a 747ER up to, which is the kind of configuration we would use for the Antarctic flight, to Los Angeles, and I spent a day with him in Los Angeles and also up on Catalina Island, working out some of the details of the flight planning, and took a really good look at the same configuration sort of we would have on the Qantas flight to see how exactly we might possibly mount the gyro platform. This is an issue that remained unresolved for some time. So emails went back and forth after that from some of the pictures I took. You know, what is this bolt attached to? Can we attach things here? Can we rip this off of the airplane? I wonder what the security people were thinking as we were sending these things back and forth. How much weight can I hang from these things? And so forth. Part of that answer came, I went back to Sydney in July of 2003. We spent actually 4 hours in this simulator, high fidelity simulator. This is where they do pilot training. They actually do a certification for 747 flight in the simulator, so it's not your Microsoft flight simulator. And we did book, we had 4 hours booked, and we did half a dozen simulations of the flight with different turbulent conditions. I was told I'm not allowed to show pictures of inside, but it looks just like a flight deck. And after 4 hours of checkout, Qantas gave it their stamp of approval to actually fly the airplane in this manner. So that was like a hurdle that we sort of got over. This is what the control screen actually looked like on this laptop. It's rather busy. We were doing the video guiding, the countdown timers that were going out over the PA system for the aircraft we've driven from here, various navigation screens and control screens for the cameras and so forth. And of course, I wanted to see the eclipse, so it went red so it'd be dark adapted so I could see the corona. This question was still unresolved, and then Jay Friedland, who was on the flight, who unfortunately couldn't be here, actually came up with a brilliant idea, sort of an out-of-the-box suggestion. He said, well, what about using some of these vacuum suction cups and sticking it on the aircraft wall? These kind that are used for carrying big, heavy cans of glass and carrying boxes and such that you can't grab a hold of. So we queried Qantas about that. Well, if we stick one in here, could we stick some there? I got an answer back from Ian Getley, who's another 747 pilot I got to know pretty well. He's actually a student in space weather and cosmic and solar radiation events, so some people here may be familiar with his work, but he's also a 747 pilot, and suggested that I actually try this on a QF-94 flight, which was the flight I took down to Melbourne, and we did, and it actually worked, and so we decided we could suspend the platform from there. So it all came together on November 23rd or 24th, local time. We wanted to put together all these crazy under files, plus the optics and avionics and electronics, and see where we go. Now, there were 120-some-odd, I believe. I may have the number wrong. Eclipse chasers, many of them are in the audience here. Most of them I didn't get to meet because I was locked in the flight deck the whole time. But we did arrange with Qantas for security arrangements for getting tools and astronomical equipment and screwdrivers and pliers and things you're not allowed to normally bring on an airplane, as well as making sure we had hand screening of films and other things. And they actually, at midnight at the Melbourne airport, had a full security crew on and were very courteous and very helpful in getting everything into the aircraft without any problems at all. So lots of hand inspection, as you'd inspect, but they were waiting for us and ready for us. So we got into the Qantas lounge without any problem at all, did pre-flight check, the flight was to go at 2 o'clock in the morning, local time. And I made my way up to the flight deck with the crew, and there's Captain John Dennis, the flight officer, Colin Alderton. There actually had two pilots and two flight officers, because it's a long flight. First order of business was to check out, as far as I was concerned. John was busy with other things, the flight management computers, and make sure they would accept things in the way. We laid in the baseline flight plan right away, in case anything else would go over. after all, which it didn't. Baseline plan was on paper, and we entered it in just to make sure before even checking out any of the computer stuff. The self-loading freight, as they call it, passengers. wonderful airlines. if you ever hear an airline person talk about SLF, you'll know what that is. The window, the actual window over here, and the riggings would go over here, and this was my seat for 15 hours. I was locked on the flight deck. Security did not allow me off of the flight deck. They do have a bathroom in there. This was my view. I know Ray Brooks, who's in the audience somewhere, was sitting over here, and that's how I saw him for the 15 hours of the flight. And I think he was happy. So on the flight deck, we did rig up the suction cup as we planned. This one was really just for safety while reading the rest of the equipment in case we had some bad turbulence or something. This had a 70-pound static load, and the whole platform weighed something like 27 pounds, so it should be okay, but I put a second one on for safety. And as the rigging is coming together over here, I had a sign. This is a vacuum pump. It's a hand vacuum pump that holds the vacuum on it. Just a reminder, and I had everybody in the flight deck. There's seven people crammed in this flight deck, reminding me to pump it often so it wouldn't fall off. The procedure check sheet I hung from the back of John's seat, as there are lots of little details of hooking up cables and such. Velcro is wonderful stuff. I left probably 8 miles of it along the flight deck somewhere. Bungee cords, it's the way the whole thing came together. The gyro power batteries and the inverters to run the 400 hertz. I was not allowed to pull off of aircraft power. We had to provide our own power. We're mounted under the pilot's seat. Power supply for the CCD and NICAD batteries for the CCD imager. We're located under the aircraft video system, which was next to the seat over here. I actually didn't sit much. Computers got sat on the seat that I was going to use. There was an electronic interface for running the video for the film cameras, and they were located over here. And another interface box I had to build to keep a vibration reduction system and a Nikon lens alive. It tends to shut itself down when it's on for too long. So here's the cabling rig. There's actually some safety cables on here that don't take any weight at all. Again, just safety against turbulence and aircraft maneuvering. Everything's hanging on one bungee cord. And the whole thing was sort of rigged up right behind John's seat, looking out that window. You can see the camera sort of sitting out there. Power inverters are actually running now. The gyros are pretty loud when they run. All the cabling came right down from the center of gravity of the platform as tight as possible so it wouldn't put any unbalanced torques on the gyro platform. Here we're sort of getting ready to go, checking things out, last minute check before putting the solar filters up on the windows, we'll see in a minute. And we had a backup computer altogether, there were three laptops that were sort of flying in here, so the next time they tell you to put your computer away because it's interfering with the flight navigation systems on an airplane, don't believe them. we're doing our pre-flight checks, getting ready to go, thanks to Jean-Luc, the guy who was taking partial eclipse photographs out of the passenger cabins. You can kind of keep a little timeline of what's going on over here. Guy Patterson was one of the Antarctic experts, or the Antarctic expert, along giving commentary to the passengers for the flight scene part. I drafted her into helping me with making sure I wasn't doing anything wrong with the check sheet. And you can see how the pilots are really busy flying here. Here's John putting on his solar filter. Here's Brian putting on his solar filter. And here's the solar filter that's over the aircraft window to protect the cameras. So we're just about ready to go. We loaded in the final set of waypoints. You can see three of the five of them here. We're getting ready to make the final turn onto the run. Everything looked right. A final pumping here, and there's a little bit of a video. I think I'm going to transition to in a moment. And a shot from Carter Roberts from the passenger cabin, and we could see the Humber approaching from 35,000 feet. It was absolutely a magnificent venue. Aircraft have never been my favorite way to do eclipses. I like to be rooted on the ground. But over the Antarctic, it's so cold. There's so few particulates. The air is clear. It is just absolutely spectacular to see it from there. Video footage was actually taken from the passenger cabin. I wanted to get the sound of what was happening back there. This is actually from the video guide camera. It's a number of frames put together, and I'll talk to that. And I very briefly step through here. Just a little bit of modest contrast enhancement as we go through. And actually, this is a composited number of frames from the video guiding platform. So we got useful imagery out of that. This is from the 400 millimeter camera. Again, a little bit of enhancement is four or five frames just subtly on top of each other. And this was to sort of get the mid-coronal regions. And I think you can see a little bit more structure coming in with some spatial filtering. And this is off of the CCD camera that was used on the platform. And this was then later put together, but not yet photometrically calibrated. Work I still have to get back with Jay, putting together with some SOHO imagery. We wanted to go from the base of the corona outward. But nothing lasts forever. We acquired back into the video guide camera to work again. Sequence taken in a wide-angle camera, which I did not have on the flight deck. This was done from the main cabin. Just one photograph of the sweep of the umbral shadow as it was going over the Antarctic. The sightseers, of course, I don't know what they were doing when the people were on the sun side of the airplane, but they actually did have quite an interesting view. And this is a little bit of a if I can advance this here. Is it moving for some reason? Oops, sorry. As the shadow receding. And this is looking at the opposite side of the aircraft, down over the cloud deck and the ice on the Antarctic. You can see the trail of the airplane, the number of miles below over here. This little winglet on the 747 is lit up in sunlight, and a little animation by put together from frames taken by Jay Friedland, where 1 second is 1 minute. And very quickly you can see the sweep of the moon shadow. It's, whoa, PowerPoint just died on me here. That's not very friendly. Sorry about that. I don't normally run Microsoft products. I'll try to restart this here. Pat, can I get an extra 5 minutes?
I think you have a friendly chairman.
This has not happened before.
While you're doing that, we could see if a question wants to come up while we wait for Microsoft.
Take some of the questions right now, that's fine.
Sure, anybody have any questions for...
Yeah.
I'm always curious what the feeling was of the people in that aircraft who didn't sit on the eclipse side.
I'll have to defer to some of the people who were in the cabin. Let's say I was locked on the flight deck for 15 hours. I know Ray or Michael or somebody can address that.
We did discuss in advance having a coordinate of flight personnel to keep people from rushing one side to the other, and that in fact did not happen.
Exactly.
It did happen?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, two instances of some incursions.
That was a uniform anyway. The place didn't go away. You had to fight them off.
The oldest idea had about
experience. How many people here were on that flight?
On the upper cabin, there was a window behind us. I think everybody on the right side of the plane, the upper cabin, you got a few seconds.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah, for some reason, I apologize. For some reason, it's not playing this video, and I apologize. There's a wonderful video, unfortunately, by Jay Friedland that shows the shadow, but it's not going to do it. So if anybody wants to see it on a laptop separately in a Macintosh QuickTime viewer, I'll be happy to show it to you. In the main cabin, Michael Gill had a camera set up. That's not playing either here. All right. Well, I apologize for both of those. They did work earlier, but unfortunately, what did work was the video imaging program and the CCD program and the film camera program. The gyro platform itself was actually dithering around on the sky a bit because the CCD, which was the prime instrument we wanted to use, it actually has a field of view that would not fully encompass the corona, so it was actually quite nice that we actually had some movement in the platform. It gets recomposited in sort of this way. You can see the sky coverage, the field coverage that we actually got with the CCD. The imager had a 16-bit readout electronic, so it has a very large dynamic range. This is actually just one exposure off of the CCD once it's composited in that sort of image mosaic. And for those who want to know what we achieved, it was a signal to noise at 3, which I consider fairly believable, per pixel out of 6 solar radii. So that's how high we went. That was in 40 millisecond integrations. This is the surface brightness profile of the corona, which was taken out of some of the imagery, a little bit of flattening, but you can see it's a very good signal to noise, and then it sort of drops off like a rock as we get out at 1200 pixels in the original size. So these are the CCD images that we obtained, just an example of some of the compositing that was done on there that Jay and I hope to use for combining with some of the SOHO imagery. And the film camera, again, was also dithered around because it was all on the same platform. So these are composited images put together to improve the signal to noise, taking out some of the film granularity, and various different ways of displaying it by renormalization, taking out the radial brightness profile and doing some spatial filtering. This is actually very, very subtle spatial filtering. It's not to look at high frequency structures in the corona. Now, John, after the event, told me that there was something wrong, which was like, I was flabbergasted. I didn't know what to say. This was actually our conversation.
There's only one thing wrong.
What's that?
There was something wrong.
What was wrong?
Why are you two sure?
So John saw the light after that. And both of these guys, John Dennis and Brian Mead, who are the two pilots we had, said any time that we need to do an eclipse flight, just call them. So I was very happy to hear that. And we assembled a group of people afterwards whom I met for 2 minutes after the flight, so I hope to really meet and talk to everybody here who was on that flight, and also anybody here who was on the Scantelescope flight, because I did the planning for that one, but have never met anybody who was on it. I'd like to hear a little bit about that. Finally,
when I look at the eclipse, I also want to take pictures. When I fiddle with the camera, I can't look. And the eclipse is short, so I'm back and forth. Look, camera, look, camera. Until I found a program called Omnifile that runs on a Mac. It runs the camera automatically, so now I can just look. Did I say it runs only on a Mac? My name is Joel Moskowitz, and I am the eclipse chaser.
Joel asked me to show that bit here, and it's actually a little promo for a poster I have out there on automatic eclipse photography. The final, I'm about out of time. Very briefly, though, there's a new piece of software I have available that people are interested in from the makers, it's me, of eFlight Number File. Jay Friedland sent me a video clip, 15 seconds or so, that he took in the flight deck, and I hope this plays, unlike the other videos. The videos just aren't playing for some reason. You can get the flavor of a rather hand-shaky video going on here. Most of the frames sort of look like this, and it is just bouncing all over the place. But a few of the frames out of the 900 sort of look like that. So I wrote a little piece of software that extracts out the frames and does automatic edge detection by a little Fourier filtering and power spectral matching, and pulls the good frames out. There are about 30 good frames or so in this video. And then does an automatic edge detection and alignment and so forth, and the media combines, and that's what you end up with. So if anybody has jittery frames from aircraft, I'd be happy to run them through that. It's not very user-friendly at the moment. It's not something that you want to run on your computer, but if you have video that you'd like cleaned up, I'd be happy to do that for you. And that's it, other than thank everybody from Qantas and for the hat that they gave me, and thanks much.
Thank you very much. For reasons that you have just seen, I can tell you from personal experience that if you ever get a chance to work with Glenn Schneider, I recommend it very highly. So how many of you, we heard how many of you were on the Qantas flight. Let's see that again. Can we get a count on the Qantas flight? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. How many were on the Scantelescope flight?
How did that work out? I mean, I read about it, but I never heard from anybody.
Well,
I'll talk to you during the break. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.